And we're live. Definitely. Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the War Room. Today, I'm going to be discussing the UFC 278 main event. Kamaru Usman taking on Leon Edwards for the second time. This time, of course, it's for the welterweight belt. I'll also talk about the rest of the fights on the card if you guys have got questions. I'm going to chat for a few minutes, just kind of give you my thoughts on the fight. And then Jamie's here to field questions from you guys, so fire away. Okay, so the welterweight belt. Now, Kamaru Usman has looked incredible since he's won the belt. He's improving every time he steps in there. He looks incredibly sharp. He's a lot different to the fighter that Leon fought the first time around. But you also have to make the same argument for Leon. He's definitely a different fighter. Now, the first time they faced off was December 19th, 2015, so it was a good while ago. It was a three-round fight. Usman won by unanimous decision. You look at it statistically and you go, okay, this is pretty clear-cut. Usman landed 126 strikes compared to 36 of Leon. He also took him down five times out of, 13 attempts. It was quite a dominant second and third round. But that first round on two of the judges' scorecards went to Leon. And I think that's interesting. I talk about it in the breakdown show. If you've had a chance to check that out on BT Sport, please do. I think it's really interesting that the first round was quite competitive and probably favoured Leon. Because it'll give Usman the everlasting memory of Leon being problematic, not being easy to control, easy to push around, easy to take down, because he certainly wasn't. Usman's success rate improved as the rounds went on. You know, he landed one of three takedowns in the first round, two of five in the second, and three of five in the third. I also said before that he landed 126 strikes. It's also worth noting that 52% of those strikes were on the floor. So if you take off half of those strikes, of course he still outstruck Leon, but that's a big difference. You know, there was a real value in him being able to take Leon down and hold him and control him and strike. And I do think that is going to be a facet of his game plan going into this next one. But I don't think it's going to be the complete picture, because I think there's a lot more to Usman now. And I also think that because they faced off the first time, and because Usman remembers how difficult Leon was to take down, and Leon's takedown right now is 70% still, I think over five rounds, Usman's going to be smart about this, and he's not going to invest loads and loads of energy in wrestling. Partly out of respect for Leon and his takedown defense, partly out of the fact that Usman's game is changing. He's more of a striker now. His takedown attempts have dropped off considerably since earlier on in his career, which I'll come back to in a little bit. But also, like, these newfound striking skills, you know, he's able to put people out with one or two punches. And, you know, believe me, it's a lot more efficient to knock somebody out than to try and take them down and control them and beat them up there. You know, that's why we see great wrestlers like Justin Gaethje, who almost completely abandon their wrestling aside from defensively, and they become strikers. You know, Chuck Liddell, another famous sprawl and brawler, you know, heavy hands, good takedown defense. His wrestling was used defensively. And I think that Usman's now much more that fighter. And defense doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't attack with takedowns. I mean, I guess I'll make this point now then. So when he fought Covington the first time, he didn't shoot any takedowns. When he fought Covington the second time, he shot one takedown, but it was a counter to pressure from Covington. We saw the same difference in the Masvidal fights. In the first Masvidal fight, he went for 16 takedowns and scored 5, so that's 31% success rate. In the second fight, he was 2 for 2, but both of those were because Masvidal was sprinting on and he tackled him and took him down. There wasn't a great deal of control. He's not trying to wrestle people to control them. That was a reactionary defensive movement to stop them crashing forward and him having to use footwork and boxing defense to get out of the way. That wrestling in the back pocket, of course, is always there, but he is using it a lot less recently, and I do think that's going to be a trend that we see go into the fight against Leon. Okay, let's have a look at the tail of the tape. So Kamaru Usman is 20-1. So he won his pro debut, then he lost his next fight by Rene Kachoke, and now he's on a 19-fight win streak. Leon is 19-3 with one no contest, but it is worth noting that all three of his losses are by decision. He's never been stopped. And we saw him a little bit wobbled against Nate, but he's never ever lost by stoppage. So that's always a little bit of a a little bit of a confidence booster coming in. You know, you can find footage of Usman having his back taken and choked out. And if I'm Leon with a couple of rear naked choke submissions on my record, I'm thinking that's my backup plan. You know, if I find myself on the floor, I can't get up, I will engage in grappling. And if I hit him and hurt him and you know, he goes down, there might be an opportunity for Leon to jump on his back and you know, put Usman in a position where he doesn't really ever find himself. That's something for Leon to be keeping in his mind. So the 2-inch height advantage goes to Leon. The 2-inch reach advantage goes to Usman. Striking output, of course, is favored by Usman at 4.66 compared to 2.62. Usman also has better striking accuracy and better striking defense. The other thing you have to consider as well when it comes to strikes landed per minute, just like we were talking about with their first fight, 126 total strikes compared to 36. Half of those strikes from Usman were on the ground. So the striking output, of course, is favored towards wrestlers because they're able to hold people in positions where they can just strike them and beat them up. And of course, all that is countered towards total strikes. Now, takedown average, Leon is actually halfway towards where Usman is, 3 per 15 minutes. Leon's at 1.48, which is, you know, a pretty good statistic considering, you know, most people would look at him as a kickboxer. Usman's takedown accuracy, of course, is 49%. It's very, very high, and his takedown defense is 100%. And I know you're going to argue with me on that. Oh, yeah, but Covington, et cetera, et cetera. Look, I'm telling you what the statistics say. I don't always agree with the statistics, and I will get into that, but I think we need to better define what is a takedown in mixed martial arts, and that's probably not for me to do. You know, we have wrestling greats like Daniel Cormier around, and I think that we could get a real better definition of what a takedown is and how that is scored, and I'm not the person to do it. But one thing I will challenge, though, is the control time, because I've looked into control time, and this is a narrative in this fight, of course, because Usman is at number one for control time in among active welterweights with an hour, 58 minutes and 12 seconds. But one thing that you also have to keep in mind when it comes to control time is that is not necessarily controlling on the floor. That's also controlling up against the fence. And I would like to make the distinction between controlling and holding. Like, there's nothing wrong with holding somebody up against the fence. You know, it's a tactic that we've seen in, you know, GSP against BJ Penn. You know, a lot of fighters use it to stifle and wear their opponents out if they're powerful strikers. That can be a very useful tool. But it, for me, control time is not the same thing. And I'll give you an example as to why this has come up. Because I went through the Usman-Edwards first fight. So Usman is credited with having 10 minutes and 50 seconds of control time. But going through and timing it round by round, he was actually only controlling him on the ground for 5 minutes and 55. So the distinction that makes sense to me is that a downed opponent is when it becomes control time. So if a knee's down, or if, you know, two hands are down or whatever, that is the downed opponent, and that's where the control time begins. There's a lot of time when Usman's holding people up against the fence and kind of slowing the action down. And for me, that could be a point when Leon could just allow the fight to slip away from him, get him frustrated, you know, try and peel off and bounce off and dig his underhooks and get off the fence. But Usman can quite easily slow that fight down and take away the movement of Leon. And I think, you know, this is a narrative that keeps coming back every time we talk about this fight. Leon has to take the initiative. And it's easier said than done, believe me, because I've been there. You know, you step in there against someone who's a great wrestler like Usman or GSP, and you go, I've got to throw. I can't wait and expect him to take me down. But then you find yourself doing it. And it's a trap that you fall into quite easily, especially if you're, you know, I mean, I'm not the most powerful of strikers, and I would say that the power in this equation doesn't go to Leon, which means that he can't expect, oh, I just need to land one and then the fight's done. He would probably need to land an accumulation of shots in order to hurt Usman. So he has to be really cautious at how he applies those strikes. At the same time, that caution can't override his willingness to be aggressive, because he'll find himself shut down by the possibility of a takedown coming. He still needs to flow and strike and stay on his toes and keep moving. If he finds himself being shut down, I think he's going to find Usman's going to become more of a striker than anything. And because Usman's got confidence in his hands, in his striking power, and he's developing from one fight to the next, that dual threat for Edwards of, is he going to take me down or is he going to stand and trade with me, is going to give him an additional layer of analysis before he can react to anything that's happening. So, you know, as every time Usman steps forward on that lead leg, is he level changing to get underneath and onto the legs and hips, or is he stepping on with a powerful jab cross? You have to make that assessment in a split second. And if Leon finds himself up against the fence, trapped like he most likely will do at portions of this fight, he's not going to have the option to move away. So he's then going to have to decide which direction he's going. And the development that we saw from Usman in the Covington fight, the second Covington fight, is that he was very good at trapping him up against the fence and walking him onto hooks. I've been very, very impressed with Usman. I wasn't a huge fan of his fighting style early on. I appreciated and respected his wrestling credentials, but when he fought Emil Mech and he kept taking him down, and I just kind of felt like he could have done more with it. And the truth is, he could, and he admitted it in the post-fight interview. And since he's become the champion, we've seen it. And the development that we're seeing from him is really quite astounding. It's a credit to the people working with him. To, you know, Trevor Whitman obviously is working with him, and he's working alongside Gaethje. But whoever is motivating him to keep growing like this as a fighter, keep doing it, because he's got so many physical attributes that can transfer very quickly to striking ability. Like his speed and his power, his ability to not draw back a punch, to just fire it and still hurt people. And then, of course, he's got that wrestling to back it up. He's a very dangerous individual. And now I get excited because I'm expecting to see something new from his game every time. With Leon, I always get a little bit anxious because I feel like he's going to hold back. I feel like he's going to find that third gear where he knows he can win the fight on points and he doesn't go, hang on a minute, let's put this guy away. Because even if you don't put the guy away, that extra little fourth gear or maybe even a fifth gear sometimes is usually what's going to tip the balance in one of these high-level title fights over five rounds with someone as tough as Usman. You need to give that extra little bit. Okay. Where shall I? So let me talk briefly about the first fight. So of course it was a long while ago. Of course, Usman won the fight. He won the second and third round comfortably. It was a frustrating fight for Leon. He never accepted being on the floor. Every time he was taken down, regardless of the time, he never looked up and was like, 15 seconds, I'll just stay here. He was always working to get himself back up to his feet. And his conditioning is unquestionable. I don't think he's going to slow down. I think he can be slowed down, but I don't think his conditioning is going to give out before his willingness to try gives out. And that's the biggest challenge, I think, for Usman. You see people break under really strong wrestlers. We saw it with Khabib all the time. You just get to the stage where you just, oh. And there was frustration on the face of Leon in that last round against Usman. And this is an additional two rounds. So it could quite easily get to that stage where that frustration becomes recklessness and he starts to scramble and you know, gives opportunities for Usman to show other parts of his game. When it hit the floor in the first round, so this is where it becomes interesting when we go back to the conversation about control, because Usman is credited with 3 minutes and 14 seconds of control in the first round. A minute 40 of that was in the clinch. And when he did take him down in the first round, he was stuck in a triangle for a minute and 15 seconds. So you've got Usman lands a takedown, you've got 30 seconds of Leon getting his guard back and controlling the wrist of Usman and setting up the triangle. And then you've got a minute and 15 of Usman in quite a deep triangle trying to get his way out of it. And then 15 seconds where he's out of the triangle. He unloads maybe 10, 12 punches as Leon's getting back to his feet. That's the end of the first round. Second and third round, it was all Usman's wrestling aggression. And he really, really was able to stifle Leon's game. It was actually quite telling, because when he fought Emil Mech, he took him down against the fence over and over again. And Emil Mech kept getting back to his feet. But when he decided he wanted to take him down and keep him down, he took him down in the open. But that was the opposite way around against Leon in the first fight. I'm of course saying that this is, I mean, I'm just looking at what's on the table, because you have to look at all these pieces in my eyes. When he took Leon down away from the fence in their first fight, he was immediately dealing with an aggressive guard. When he was taking Leon down against the fence, Leon was very good at building himself back up and stripping wrist grips. It was rare that he was on both shoulders. So there might be a question of whether Usman wants to take him down and hold him down or use the fence to grill him, you know, like DC did against Anthony Johnson and Derek Lewis, to keep taking him down until they're sick of trying to get back up and then, you know, then look for the finish. That's the second plan for Usman. The first plan, I think, is to keep reminding Leon that there's that threat, that level change there, but then keep picking him off with those hands when he's hesitant to throw himself. On Leon's side, if he is able to keep space, I expect him to work the lead leg, although of course he's going to have to set up his low kicks because there is a risk of Usman trying to catch them. He worked really well with the front kick in the last fight as well, and I wouldn't be surprised if he starts throwing some high kicks in there as well. You remember his fight against Pavel Pavlak? Caught him right at the side of the neck and just dropped him to the canvas. I think a variety of kicks from Edwards would make Usman less willing to close into that distance and run onto a knee or a foot. The front kicks at the midsection were quite useful. I mean, Leon was using them in the first fight, and I think we're going to see a development in Leon's game and his kicking game, which would be useful if he has the confidence to throw it against Usman. I think working Usman's lead leg would be good and staying on the outside, and then when Usman does close in to try and strike, go straight into that punching range and through it and then work to clinch. This is where Leon does a lot of his best work. You know, you watch him against Gunnar Nelson where he turns him off and smashes him with that left elbow. We saw it over and over again against RDA as well. Single neck tie, left elbow. All of these kind of things, especially over a 25-minute fight, if you can cause swelling or damage, aiming for cheekbones and eyebrows and eye sockets, anything like that, noses, you know, do anything, any kind of permanent damage. Like a calf kick will be useful, but the leg can recover to a point in the fight. If you get cut or your nose gets broken, that is a permanent deficiency that now you're dealing with for the rest of the fight. So if it happens in the first round, even better. I think Leon needs to be a surprise for Usman this time around because Usman's got a perspective of who Edwards was from the first one. What haven't I talked about? I mean, I think we'll see some grappling from Edwards. I think I would be confident to try and put my grappling on the table. And I think Usman, especially after listening to his post-fight interview from their first fight, he talked about the fact that he wanted to show striking, but then he wasn't feeling it tonight. I think he's going to want to really make a point. And I think he's proved his striking in his last three fights to himself, especially against Masvidal. Okay. Have we got anything I haven't talked about? Yeah, I mean, the vulnerability for kicks of Usman is something you have to consider. 15 of 15 for Masvidal in the second fight. That's quite a lot. Okay, have we got any questions, Jamie? Oh, Jamie's got his mic. He's got to turn it on. Spill his tea.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, I'm on. Okay.
Yeah, we have got a few questions. The one that, a few people have mentioned, how do you think Usman would do against Khamzat?
Yeah, this is a question I expected to get, to be honest. I don't know. This is, of course, people have seen my comments about the Khamzat against Nate Diaz fight, and I just don't think that's a fair fight. Of course, I was being facetious when I was talking about the someone pressing charges, but it's a bit of an assassination, isn't it? Let's be honest. The other downside to it is that we're not really going to learn. I don't expect to learn much more from Hamza. If the fight goes the way I expect it to, I think he's going to take Diaz down and beat him up from top position, and Diaz is going to be trying to do something from bottom position, but find himself smashed into the canvas under a much bigger, stronger, powerful wrestler, and I think he'll be brutalized there like Khamzat did to John Phillips and Rhys McKee. Of course, you know, I know you're going to say, yeah, but Nate Diaz jiu-jitsu, etc. You only need to land a few clean punches on Nate before he's a bloody mess, and that fight will be stopped because of cuts. I'm certain of it, because that's always the kryptonite for Diaz. If you can hit him enough, you'll do enough damage for the referee to intervene. I kind of veered off a point. The downside is that we're not really going to learn a great deal about Chimaev in this fight. I mean, you know, we're gonna hope for the toughness of Diaz to make it competitive, but you look at the guys that are around Chimaev. I mean, you know, he's not facing a Covington or a Burns or a Muhammad or a Sean Brady or Jeff Neal. Like, he's not facing any of these guys. Like there have been guys that have been kind of lingering in the top 10 that I think would be a decent test for him. But of course, this is where, you know, this is where the UFC model, you find someone that's incredibly marketable and you push them right up into a position and make their life a bit easier to get to those heights. I think the thing is with Chimaev, you could put him against anybody in the top 15, and I would most likely back him to win. I think he's a terrifying individual, and I think he absolutely is going to live up to the hype around him. Whether he's ready to fight Kamaru Usman right now or not, I don't know. You know, I can imagine Usman being able to force him to work really hard for any wrestling exchanges he gets, and that's where we might see the conditioning, the gas tank of Chimaev. It might not be ready for five rounds. I don't know. I'm excited. Genuinely, I'm excited. I remember watching his first couple of fights. I remember the hype around him. Everybody at All Stars talks so highly of him, and that is a mat full of killers as well. There's a lot of good fighters in that gym. But when I see a lot of people talking about Chimaev the way that they are, I kind of feel like he's probably the most difficult test in the division for Usman. It won't surprise me if we see Usman move up a weight class or two after this and try his chances, because it's much better to go up to light heavyweight and lose to Prochazka, or go up to middleweight and lose to Paulo Costa or someone like that, than it would be to stay in the division and lose to Chimaev. Just my personal opinion. And I think that could happen. Okay. What do you reckon? More?
Yep, we got one from Conturk67. Do you think Leon's wrestling has improved as much as Usman's striking since their last fight?
Yes. I think it has. I think what the challenge with wrestling and striking, if you put the two skill sets on the table, you can get a few pieces from the striking skill set and make them really effective at a very high level. When it comes to wrestling, you need a decent amount of experience with all of the main facets of wrestling in order to really have any success with any of it. It's a lot harder to learn wrestling, in my opinion. Maybe I'm biased because I'm coming from it as a striker, but I feel like guys that come from wrestling, they're able to go, well, I've got wrestling, so if I add jab, cross, and a hook and maybe an overhand, I can beat a lot of people. And that is, you know, in the history of MMA, that's kind of what we've seen. We've seen a lot of wrestlers come into the sport and become strikers. Like, you remember Josh Koscheck coming in? He was a good wrestler. You know, he predominantly became a striker, trained out of AKA. When he fought GSP, he'd neglected his wrestling so much that GSP was able to take him down. And that was a real shock to him. Now, this is where Edwards might be able to throw a wild card out there. Because Usman is probably not expecting Edwards to try and take him down. But Edwards has got good wrestling. There's no reason why he can't make the most of Usman stepping hard on one of those jab crosses and a level change under him. He doesn't need to take him down and control him. But it would certainly throw an additional storyline into the mix for Usman. And of course, people weren't expecting Alex Gustafsson to take down John Jones. But he was the person that took away John Jones's 100% takedown defense. Of course, Usman, blah blah blah. He's not got 100% takedown offense, etc., etc. And I can just hear the mutterings of a few people in the comment section. I know. Tell me what you think. Like, do we need to define actually what a takedown is? Like, for me, the point when you can't kick or knee somebody in the head legally, that's a downed opponent, and that would be a good time to start the time of control, because nobody wants to be put on the floor when they're trying to fight against it. You can be held up against the fence and be frustrated, and it doesn't really feel like control to me. It feels like holding. Anyway, it's a conversation for another time. Go on, Jamie, what we got? Sip of tea. I'm all colour coordinated today. Have you seen? I've got... Carry on.
Looks good. A lot of people are asking about how do you think Usman would do at light heavyweight?
You know... I don't know. I don't know. I keep hearing people mention about Usman and knee injuries, and I don't know whether that's the case. I don't know whether that's why his wrestling has dropped off. I don't know. But going up in weight, if there's any kind of knee injury, going up in weight is not the right thing to do, because it's only going to put more strain and more power through those joints. I think, to be honest, the best thing to do would be for him to stay at welterweight for the time being. I know he doesn't want to go up and fight Adesanya, but Adesanya's got Alex Pereira coming up. And if Pereira is able to take the belt off Adesanya, I would immediately be calling for that title shot if I was Usman. I know it would kind of cause a bit of a mess at middleweight if Usman were to win the belt, but you know, this is the sport, and I feel like if Usman's going to get another belt, it's probably going to be middleweight and not light heavyweight. Like, Adesanya thought he could go up to light heavyweight and compete with Yan, and he massively underestimated him. You've got to think, Usman moving up two weight classes, even if he fights somebody in the top five. I mean, you know, Prohaska, of course, is the champ, but Glover Teixeira, Jan Błachowicz, Magomed Ankalaev, Alexander Rakic, Anthony Smith, they're all big, strong individuals with a lot of skills on the table. There's a point when strength and size is a factor, especially when it comes to like the highest levels of the sport. This is why people are still weight cutting. You know, you don't think it's going to make that much of a difference, but sometimes you come up against someone that's 15 or 20 pounds heavier, and that is well hydrated muscle mass, and it does make a difference. It might take away his opportunity to wrestle, which might, I don't know. We'll see. What else, Jamie?
There's one regarding Luke Rockhold. Mm-hmm. What do you think of his comments during media day about the UFC and bonuses and stuff?
I mean, I think he's right, isn't he? You know, and I think we all know he's right, and I think all the fighters know he's right as well. You know, it's not like you got to remember this, right? You got to remember this, and this is maybe a message to all young fighters out there. The key is in the word. The UFC is a promotion. It's a promotion. It's there to promote you. If you are promotable, you're valuable. If you're not promotable, you're not valuable. It's a weird thing because when you join the UFC, like, you're kind of taken in like it's a family, and like, oh my God, you've come to join us. We're all crusading to, you know, to legitimize MMA together. At least this was the feeling when I joined. And even in the meetings that we had with Dana before, like after the weigh-ins. So back in the day when weigh-ins was actually 4 o'clock and you get on the scales and actually make weight at that time, and then people would hydrate at the arena. Before everybody left to go back to the hotel, we would get taken into a smaller separate room with Dana and Joe Silver and maybe somebody else, a couple of other people. And Dana would always give this little kind of rousing speech about, you know, we're all in this together, go out and give a good performance, represent MMA, represent the UFC. And in that brief moment, in a room full of people that are all highly trained and want to kill each other, we all kind of stop and look around and go, yeah, no, we kind of are all in this together. And it's easy to buy into that. It's easy to feel like, yeah, that's how it is. Like, I'm a part of the UFC family now. And then you win the belt and lose it, or you don't quite get there or whatever. And immediately you become cannon fodder for the next people that are more promotable than you. Like, you've got to maintain your own value in the marketplace as a fighter. Unfortunately for Rockhold, he's one of the lucky ones. I think he's a good-looking dude. You know, he's a highly skilled martial artist. Like, he can hold his value in the marketplace just as Francis Ngannou can, which is why he's speaking out. But what we need is a whole bunch more people that can hold their value in the marketplace to do the same thing. And this is where we're struggling, because, like, one person will speak out and then they'll get punished and chastised and cut and embarrassed, and then somebody else will speak out and the same thing will happen to them. And, like, look at what's happened with Nate right now. Like, he's not leaving the UFC on good terms. You know that for sure, which is why he's not getting a farewell, Nate, have this great fight, let's celebrate you one last time before you leave the octagon. He's getting Chimaev. And you've seen the Dosbrack painting. I mean, that guy nails it every time. Like, I feel something about something, and that guy paints a picture that illustrates it perfectly. The picture of the fire escape and the exit sign with Chimaev sitting on the top of it and Dana looking through the little glass window. It's kind of how it feels. You know, the way it was edited with Chimaev carrying the leash across the cage and Dana laughing and stuff. It's a little bit vulgar. And I think we all kind of know it. And that's what's sad about when we see people like Rockhold and Ngannou speaking out, because we want athletes to be happy and content and want to promote the sport and the UFC and their fights, you know, focus on their career, their training, instead of getting caught up with the politics and the nonsense of it. It's a real shame. I remember when it happened to me and I was like, oh, okay. I'm not who I thought I was in this organization. And this was like, you know, GSP, then Condit, and then Anthony Johnson. I'm like, okay, that like, I feel like I've kind of pissed somebody off here. Like, I'm not even getting any kind of breather recovery fight. Like, that's kind of how they do it, you know, and it always has been like that. But you don't find out until you're no longer as valuable to the promotion as you were when you first came in. And that's where Luke Rockhold's found himself. You know, he lost two fights in a row. He's been knocked out. He was knocked out by Romero. He was knocked out by Błachowicz. The UFC are kind of, yeah. You know, he's like late 30s now as well. They're a promotion. It's a business, you know. They didn't build a sport. They built a corporation. And we all have to kind of remember that. Like, it's difficult sometimes when you're in it as a fighter to recognize it. But with the fighters that are speaking out right now, all the young fighters need to listen. It's important because something needs to change. Otherwise, we're going to continue going down this path and lots of fighters are going to be poor and unhappy when they retire. Not that Rockhold is going to be poor or unhappy. Good looking dude. Anyway, more questions, Jamie? Do you like my sweatshirt, by the way? A little twist on the end of the dragon logo. Go on, Jamie, sorry.
Yeah, we have got quite a lot of questions, to be honest. Okay. One that keeps coming up is an early prediction on Oliveira and Islam.
Oh, honestly, when I get the call from BT Sport, they're like, hey, we need you to start working on the Oliveira Makhachev breakdown. I'm going to have to take a week off and switch my phone off. That is going to be an immersive experience. I'm going to need hydration. I'm going to need some alpha brain. It's going to be a real deep dive, that is. I honestly right now couldn't tell you which way I'm leaning. I think, of course, Oliveira has got more... I think he's got more all-round finishing skills. I think he's got more submission options and he's got a better striking skill set, especially at this point in his career. He does get hit a lot, but he does take a shot well. That's not a good thing, but he does, and it might keep him in the fight for longer than some others. I think the one loss on Makhachev's record has really done him a favour as well, because the growth that we saw after that loss to Adriano Martins was massive. He's a far more patient and calculated striker now, and we know he's got the wrestling. The thing is with the two, like you've got Charles, who kind of plays at striking until he lands something, and he'll play at jiu-jitsu until he'll catch something, whereas Makhachev can cut straight through that with wrestling. And that's the thing I keep coming back to. You know, you can be a great wrestler and you've got someone who's a good striker and someone who's a good grappler, and you can manage that fight so they can never really get comfortable in either one of those ranges. If you're a grappler and you've got no wrestling, you can't take it there. And if you're a striker and you've got no wrestling, you can't keep it there. So I always have to lean towards the wrestler in mixed martial arts, especially if it's such a strong wrestler in Makhachev. The one thing on Oliveira's side is that this is kind of his second career around, and there's a lot to be said for experience. Like it was the reason that Glover Teixeira got a title after 40 years old. Experience is massive. And I do feel like this might be Oliveira's time. But if we're lucky, this is going to be an epic trilogy that we're going to enjoy over the next 12 to 18 months. And although I love the lightweight division to keep moving, I could see these guys fight three times in a row because I think it's going to be competitive. I think it's going to be controversial. And I think we're going to see the highest level of mixed martial arts that we could possibly see on the table, expressed by two guys that are actually very different in expressing it. Didn't really answer your question at all. I'm sorry. I hope you're a bit more excited for the fight now, because I am, though. What else we got, Jamie?
Okay, so just going back to this week's card, your thoughts on Paulo Costa's physique this week? He looks shredded and motivated. Makes me nervous for Luke.
Yeah, he does look in good shape. I mean, he always looks in good shape. You know, this is well, say no, hang on a minute. I should take that back. I've spoken too soon, very quickly. He always looks in good shape apart from his last fight. Now, I got a bit of heat on the comments on the breakdown show because I said he didn't look very good against Marvin Vettori. And I stand by it. I don't think he looked good against Marvin Vettori. You know, there were moments where it was competitive and, you know, Marvin Vettori did take a few kicks and punches, but he was also taking him from a guy that came in at fight week 25 pounds overweight. You know, it's not like he was out of shape. He didn't have the same conditioning perhaps that he would normally, but that additional weight and muscle mass makes a difference. Whether Vettori wants to stand and trade strikes with him or grapple with him, it's going to make a difference. And somebody coming in that overweight shows me that they're not in a position where they should be competing, which is also, you know, psychologically, I don't think he was in a very good state. And I don't know whether that's any different now. I was surprised at how confident Luke Rockhold seems this week, because I felt like, you know, he's got, what is he, 16-5 is his record. He's got 5 losses on his record and all 5 of them are by stoppage. I kind of felt like he was going to be a little bit unsure of himself, a little bit awkward in front of the camera this week, and I expected Paulo Costa to be quite brash and confident and have his swagger back, because he probably feels like he's being set up to get a good win on his record over Luke Rockhold, because he's a heavy-handed guy with a lot of volume striking, and Luke Rockhold doesn't take the heaviest of punches well. The thing is with these two, though, it's all so much down to how they're feeling about themselves in the moment. And I think that if Rockhold starts well, if he starts off really nice and he keeps landing that lead right jab and stinging him and slapping him with that hook and walking him onto that body kick, and you start seeing Paulo Costa doing the finger and the that don't hurt and all that kind of stuff, like he does when he's starting to get frustrated, like he did against Adesanya and like he did against Vettori, that's when Rockhold's confidence is going to start to creep up. And Rockhold's always got that knowledge that he's got that jiu-jitsu skill set. I don't think, I know you'll say, well, yeah, but he's got a black belt. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone is a fantastic grappler in MMA if they have a black belt. It means they may have done the time to earn themselves a black belt, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's transferred over to mixed martial arts. And I just don't see that in Paulo Costa's game. With Luke Rockhold, we know he's a good grappler. Like, we know he's got grappling skills. Look, we've got one submission on Paulo Costa's record, and then there was the guillotine on The Ultimate Fighter. So he's got a guillotine and a rear naked choke. Rockhold, we've seen him sub guys at the UFC level and be very slick about it. You know, the inverted triangle against Tim Boesch was one of my favorite fights to watch because of the way he cinches it up as he's rolling with it. You know, the one-arm guillotine against Michael Bisping, of course, and, you know, rear naked choke in Lyoto Machida. I think there's a real option for Luke to take this fight to the ground and use his jiu-jitsu skills. But it all comes down to confidence. And that's where these two guys, they're so shaky. I said it in the war room. I'll steal the phrase again off my good friend. That it's like two glass cannons. You know, the first one to take a shot might be the first one to crumble. I'm excited for it, though. I'm kind of leaning towards Paulo Costa at this stage, but I feel like Luke is probably the better all-round martial artist. Yeah. Okay. What else, Jamie?
So, we've got one from Dufan. Actually, I'm not going to say that name. I'm going to butcher it. do you see Leon versus Usman not going the distance?
Yeah, I could see it not going the distance. Absolutely, I could see a few different ways of it ending. I think most likely, if we see it end, it's going to either be Usman catching Edwards clean and dropping him and getting the TKO finish on the floor, or Edwards catching Usman and hurting him and jumping on his back and taking a rear naked choke. Like they're the two main scenarios I can see to finish, and I think that if it happens, it might be Usman in the third, fourth round. And he might just be able to, he might have found that moment where Leon's kind of, he started to coast a little bit, he started to get comfortable, and then wham, he steps in and lands a clean shot. Again, like he did against Masvidal, the right hand with the threat of the level change underneath it. Like, do you block or do you defend? Like, it's got to be one or the other. And Edwards might at that stage have been shot on a few times and might be more inclined to level change his hands than to bring his hands up and block. And like, I could definitely see that happening. I could also see Edwards catching Usman. Like, imagine him, like, hits him with that clinch, he catches him with that left elbow, and you see Usman kind of doing a bit of a dance. Edwards gets excited and runs him down, lands a couple more strikes, and Usman loses his footing, and then Edwards smoothly takes his back and sinks in that rear naked choke just before there's been a moment for him to really gather himself and figure out what's going on. I could definitely see that happening as well. Yeah, fascinating fight. Fascinating.
So we've got a question from Mars Martin.
Mm-hmm.
So future matchups that you're most excited for, number three, Jones versus Ngannou.
Yep.
Izzy versus Pereira, or Usman versus Chimaev.
Which one am I most excited about? Well, that's a bit of an unfair question. I don't know. Jones is fighting Miocic next, isn't he? Is that the next one that's sorted out? Yeah. I'm excited for that one, but I do very much feel like that's Jones going, just let me fight one person before Ngannou. I don't care who it is. I think that's a really interesting fight because, like, there are a lot of the things that made John Jones distinctive as a light heavyweight. You know, his height and reach. I mean, not so much anymore because light heavyweights have kind of grown around him since he was the champion. But his reach, 84.5 inches, is massive. You know, most heavyweights can't compete with that. But then if he goes up a weight class, he's dealing with people that are physiologically bigger and stronger and probably more able to take some of his punches and not as easy to take down. You know, there's going to be an adjustment for John Jones. I think Stipe is going to be a real good litmus test for him because if he's able to get past Stipe, which my money, of course, is on John Jones at this point, but again, I'm hoping to break that one down and really get into it when the time comes. Jones versus Ngannou is a really, really interesting fight because although we've seen improvements from Ngannou, we've seen him be able to wrestle now. I don't think he's going to come in and wrestle John Jones, but if he decides to, it's still going to be a really difficult thing for John Jones to deal with purely because of the size and strength of Francis Ngannou. The other thing with Ngannou is if he decides to go, John Jones has to get out of the way. He can't play on the inside and, you know, lock horns, as he says, and work his elbows because he'll just get steamrolled by Ngannou. That's a different prospect to what he's probably going to be facing as a light heavyweight. So for me, just John Jones at heavyweight is the most interesting thing right now because I still hold him in that high regard as, you know, one of the best mixed martial artists on the planet. We're seeing great martial artists within MMA. But John Jones is one of the best all-round mixed martial artists that I've seen. And him moving up to heavyweight and being able to kind of grow into his frame, he might be the best fighter that we'll ever see. But we just need to see this heavyweight version of him. Yeah? What we got?
So I think Corey Sandhagen versus Song Yadong has just been announced.
Oh, that's a good one.
So, yeah, people have just been asking for your early prediction on that.
I kind of instinctively, straight away, just favour Corey Sandhagen. I think Song is a real talent, but I think he's quite a raw talent. And I think someone like Corey Sandhagen, although obviously he's had his opportunities at the top of the division, I think he's just underneath that top bracket of fighters. And he's not that far off it either. I mean, like, look who's above him. He's ranked number four. He's got Aldo, Dillashaw, Peter Yan, and Sterling above him. I think on the right day, Corey Sandhagen could beat any of those guys. But I think his odds are lower than... If he fought each one of those guys 10 times, I would expect him to win 2 or 3. I think he is competitive. I just don't think he's got all the pieces right together. And I think Song Yadong is probably another 12 to 18 months behind him. Maybe not in skills, but in his maturity and his approach. There's a lot of potential for Song Yadong, and he's got a lot of power in his hands, and he's a very exciting and explosive kid. But at that very, very top level, the thing that makes the difference is the decision-making. And Corey Sandhagen always impresses me. What we got?
I mean, people have obviously mentioned the Hamzat Diaz fight as well.
Yeah.
Do you still think the UFC should be charged for putting that against Hamza?
I did address that earlier. Look, it was a figure of speech. I was being a little bit silly. Of course, like, you know, Diaz has signed the contract. He has agreed to take this fight. He's signed his waiver, and, you know, we all know that that is it's a legitimate sporting contest. The point that I was making is that, like, no one's going to feel bad when Diaz gets ironed into the canvas. And I know that, I know there are loads of Diaz fans out there. Like, I say this and people think, oh, you must hate the Diaz brothers. And I don't. I'm a big fan of the Diaz brothers. But I'm also realistic about where they are in their career. Like, if I tell you something, if I tell you I think someone's really good and I think they're really good, if I say they're going to struggle, it means I genuinely think they're going to struggle. And it's not because I dislike them in any way. Like, if Nate is able to pull this off, just as a big middle finger to Dana before he leaves the UFC, I think we all would like to see that, because we all love that underdog story, and that is absolutely the position that Nate's being put in. But it's so difficult to beat the man, especially when the man's got the machine behind him, and especially when the machine has got fighters to throw in your way like Khamzat Chimaev. The point I was making is it's just an unfair fight, and it's not a very good way of appreciating someone that's done so much to market the UFC and draw so many eyes to it. It's going to be a fight. Nate is going to do his best. I just feel like he's not big enough or strong enough in this division to be able to deal with someone like Chimaev at this point. He may never have been. You know, he is a lightweight, and there's no way Chimaev's going down to lightweight. Oh, okay. I hope that clears that up for you. What we got?
Okay, so Warrior 1250 asks, what are your dream matchups in the 155 division?
Ooh, okay, right. Well, it just so happens I have the UFC rankings in front of me. So, dream matchups in this division. I mean, there's a lot of good matchups in this division. I think, you know, I mean, like, imagine Fazeev against Gaethje would be an absolute banger. I think you could put Gamrot up there against any of the top guys. I mean, Gamrot against Chandler or Poirier would be great, fantastic fights. I see Armin Sarukian's another one we've got to keep our eye on. There are a lot of interesting matchups in this division. It's still kind of divided into two. Like, you look at half of these guys and they're like, they're on the downward slope of their career in this weight class. And then there's some of the other ones like Fazeev and Sarukian and Gamrot who are on their way up. This weight class. Where is what's his name? Why is he not there? Gillespie. I thought he was in the top 15. Has he been moved out? That's a shame. Yeah, it's always been one of the deepest weight classes and one of the most competitive. You could really just put all these in a bag and mix them up, and you could draw matchups out of a hat, and each one would be exciting. I'd like to see some of the younger guys in their career start to get some cracks at the bigger dogs though at the top of the division before they start to find their way out. You know, the likes of, I mean, Gaethje against Fazeev would be a good one. Gaethje against RDA would be a lot of fun to watch as well, just for two old boys going at it. Yeah. Okay. What else, Jamie? What else?
Okay, so we just had one through. What do you think between the matchup between Gamrot and Dariush?
I think we're going to see Gamrot really show his skills. Of course, you know, Dariush is a really skilled fighter. He's a very good test for anybody coming up in this weight class. I don't know as I've seen the skills that he's going to need to make that jump to right at the top of the division. I do feel like Gamrot does have that potential, though. You know, he got a really, really rough outing in his first fight against Goram Khatateladze, who's another one you've got to keep an eye on. I'd like to see him start to compete more regularly. Gamrot is a very, very skilled fighter. He's got very, very good transitions. He's a very high-level grappler, and he has a lot of good experience on the Polish circuit, and the Polish circuit is one of the toughest in the world because everybody in Poland loves MMA. There's an MMA event on every other night in every other town. I mean, you know, I spent a week over there ahead of the UFC's first event in Krakow, and we drove around in a minibus for a week, calling into little venues and watching fights. And honestly, the level everywhere was really high. And that was several years ago. That was when Joanna just won the belt. Like, you've got to think that the experience that he brings from those early days has set him up perfectly for this moment he's in right now. I feel like Gamrot's going to go all the way, to be honest. It wouldn't surprise me if he's in a title shot in the next sort of three or four fights.
So we just had another one through from Man in Black. What are your thoughts on the MVP and Mike Perry fight this weekend?
It's a weird one, isn't it? It's a weird one. I was chatting to Mystery about it earlier because obviously he's been going down to London shoot with the Jimmy and Josh for sparring and stuff. And MVP is just a wizard. He's so good. He's such a dangerous. He's such a lethal striker. Like you watch people. I mean, like Jimmy Warlead doesn't. You know, he's got all the skills on the table that you need. He's a very, very difficult sparring match for everybody. And you watch him get in there against MVP and this like ebb and flow that MVP's got, where you're like, even a veteran like Jimmy's like not quite sure when to go because he like casts this spell over his sparring partners. Whenever Jimmy speaks highly of somebody, I'm always going to be impressed with them. But even more so impressed watching him for myself. I'm like, wow, he's so long range. Thing is with this, it's a weird one because it's bare knuckle and he's fighting Mike Perry, who's abandoned any care of his face a long, long time ago. MMA would be a different thing. If MVP was fighting Mike Perry in MMA, I would expect him to be splitting his face open with a knee. But because this is boxing, there's going to be moments where MVP is going to close him right down and he's going to be clubbing him with bones on his cheeks and on his brow and stuff. And my only concern is that he might be taking unnecessary superficial damage. I hope he's getting a lot of money, and I'm sure he is getting a lot of money. But it's a very risky thing to do, to take a bare knuckle fight in the middle of your mixed martial arts career. Especially because, you know, if he gets cut and has to have stitches, it's going to take him out for a good while. It's going to delay the progress of his MMA career, which I know we're all like very excited about. But the truth is, I'll be wanting to watch it. You know, I like Mike Perry because he's a bit of a wild man, and I know how skilled MVP is and how slick he is. I just don't know how well that's going to transfer to bare knuckle and how much energy it's going to take trying to keep Mike Perry off. Like, you can't just keep blasting people with bare knuckles because you'll end up breaking your hands. And someone that's abandoned the care of their face. Like, I was on the plane back with Mike Perry when he broke his nose against, was it Vicente Luque? Like, proper spread his nose across his face. He don't care. He's not bothered. It's Mike Perry. He's going to be quite happy to walk through those punches. And the fact that MVP doesn't have that flying knee that he about decapitated Cyborg with, I think it's going to be even more difficult to keep Mike Perry off him. But I'll be watching it for sure. I'm interested.
Okay, so just had another one through. Who would you like to see McGregor fight for his comeback fight?
Tony Ferguson, Michael Chandler, Justin Gaethje, Wonderboy, Stephen Thompson, Gilbert Burns. How many names do you want? Like, you could just go through the weight classes. I could give you a list. Like Conor's at number 12 now. Tony's at number 11. Tony, I know, has been back in training, and who's he been working with? That's why I'm. Is it Six Gun? Has he been training with Six Gun? And I know he's been doing a lot of work with a new coach recently, and a coach I know is a very high level martial artist. So I think I'd like to see that. Tony against Conor, you know, a bit above. You've got RDA, that would be a good one. Chandler, of course, because, you know, Chandler's kind of at that, you know, the golden years of his career where he's looking to go out with a bang. You kind of feel that the way he's had his last couple of fights. Or, you know, if you're looking at welterweight, I mean, of course, there's the Masvidal fight, which would be massive money, but I think McGregor needs to come back and just step on the scales and have an impressive fight first. I saw Wonderboy's matched up as well, isn't he? Is he fighting Kevin Holland? I think I saw that. I think I saw Wonderboy against Kevin Holland. But Wonderboy would be a great fight for McGregor. You know, a really interesting challenge, a really long-range striker that can use his legs as well. I think it might be a bit of a handful for McGregor, to be honest. But, you know, there are a lot more difficult fights at welterweight for him. I mean, he could fight Chimaev. They wouldn't do that to him, would they? What else, Jamie? What else we got? We've got a couple of thousand people.
So we did have a few more come in.
Okay.
We've got one regarding Umar Nurmagomedov.
Yep.
So how do you think he'll perform in the upper echelon of the bantamweight division?
So, okay, let's chart a little path for him. So Umar Nurmagomedov, he fights Pedro Munhoz, Rob Font, and then TJ Dillashaw. That's a good way for the top for him. Or he could fight Ricky Simon, Rob Font, and Peter Yan. I could just put him in any of those fights. I think he's a very, very skilled individual. It's just the case of like who they match him up with and how much they want to challenge him before he gets into that top five. Or if, in fact, they just want to kind of jump him up because, you know, like Sean O'Malley's not going to want to fight him. Frankie Edgar doesn't. It's not a fight that he deserves to have. Same as Nate against Chimaev. Like Dominic Cruz, of course, you know, he's going to be out for a while. And he doesn't need to be fighting any of these young killers. He didn't really need to be fighting Marlon Vera, aside from the fact that he wants to get back to the belt. Same with Jose, you know. Like Jose is taking a big risk here against Merab. I think Merab is an absolute nightmare of an opponent for Jose. I think the saving grace is that it's over three rounds. But still, you know, Umar, when he starts making waves up towards the top, I think he's going to find people are going to be disappearing into the bushes like Homer Simpson. I don't think many people are going to want to fight him. What are you saying, Jamie?
Yeah, there's a lot of questions still coming through. So there's been rumblings of DC making a comeback. If so, how do you think he would stack up against the current division, light heavyweight?
Someone's trolling me right now, aren't they? I have for sure. Is that for real? DC?
I've heard like...
No chance. We are not going to see DC back in the octagon again. There is no chance. All of these heavyweights are getting bigger and bigger. Like, you know, Pavlovich, Aspinall, you know, Rosenstrike, Romanov, who's fighting at Tabora this weekend. I don't think we're going to see DC in there. You know, imagine him trying to get his hands on Ngannou or Cyril Gane. I just don't think we're going to see it. I think he's found his comfortable spot now, and he deserves to to enjoy his retirement from cage side and educate us all about his dietary requirements while he's commentating. We all love DC. Okay. No, don't come back, DC. Don't come back. But he'd probably say the same thing to me, and I'd tell him to do one. More? What we got?
So, one that's just come through, Thomas the Tank Engine.
Oh, yeah, Thomas the Tank Engine. I was a big fan when I was a kid. I was a big fan of you when I was a kid.
So, who are you picking on the Paris card in the main event and co-main? Cyril Gane versus Ty and Whitaker. Vittori, is it?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. I kind of always find myself underestimating Tai Tuivasa, and I think he's a lot. I think he plays down his intelligence quite well. You know, with his videos on his Instagram stories of him wet in the bed and stuff. I think when it comes to fighting, he has a real instinct for it. I mean, he's able to close people down and connect, and it's one of those fight changing kind of punches. The challenge in this fight is that he's got someone that's probably more mobile than any other heavyweight, perhaps right now or that we've ever seen. I could see Cyril absolutely outpointing him and making it a very, very frustrating fight for him, like prodding him in the stomach with his front kicks and chopping his lead leg. Like Ty does kind of wander, like he just kind of walk a little bit flat-footed. He can cover distance when he decides to move, but the majority of his movement's not hugely athletic. He's quite flat-footed. You'll also notice as well there's a slight bend in his knees that's not the right way. And if I'm Cyril, I'm working on that low kick all the time. I'm going to be trying to jar that as he's stepping forward to make him more hesitant to be aggressive. It wouldn't surprise me if we see Cyril just dance around him and outpoint him for 25 minutes and really make Ty look like he can't cover the distance to catch him. Who knows? If Ty closes him down and forces him up against the fence, we also don't know what size the cage is going to be in this one. I don't know what size Aries use. I know they use the same arena. Is it the Globe? I think it is, isn't it? I can just see Cyril doing what he does to the majority of the big punches that he does, stay on the outside and pick at them. And I think some of the fighters that he's already faced are more mobile than Ty Tuivasa. It's just whether he underestimates Ty, because I think that could be a real danger. There was another question, wasn't there, about the co-main event. It's Whitaker against Vittori?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Whitaker's the better all-round fighter. I think he's the more skilled martial artist. I think his striking's a bit more dynamic and a bit looser and more fluid. And I think therefore it probably lands with a little bit more power than Vittori. And I think he's probably got better jiu-jitsu skills as well. But I always use this same analogy because he reminds me of the guy who sits on the edge of the mat, ready for rolling, and no one wants to roll with him. Like there were a couple at 10th Planet because they would manhandle everybody. They'd smush your face into the canvas and use the point of their elbow to pass your guard and, you know, just all the mean stuff that most people don't do in the gym and they save it for competition. Like that's Vettori's programming. And I think that meanness and that hustle that he's got could be, it could be a little bit unnerving for Rob. He could bully him a little bit. I think if Rob's able to keep on his toes and outstrike him, I think we might be able to see a very well-rounded mixed martial arts performance from Rob, where he's using his, you know, that stinging low lead hand that he's got and keeps sweeping that high kick up onto the side of Vettori's neck. But I also think we might see Rob wrestle and grapple a bit more, put Vettori on his back and slow him down and, you know, try and take his back as he's scrambling to his feet. Because Vittori's a bit of an orc when it comes to, you know, and I can imagine that there's a bit more finesse in Rob Whittaker's game where if he does take him down, he sees that scramble and he's able to sneak that hook in. And against most people on the mat where Vittori's rolling, he'd be able to just orc it up to his feet and just shake him off, you know, throw him onto another partner that's rolling over next to you or something and crush a couple of people. That's what I can imagine happening to him all the time in the gym. But in MMA, like that, overconfidence in that ability just to hustle and shake somebody off might be different, especially if Rob starts kind of fast and jumps on his back when he's dry and there's still that friction. I'm leaning towards Rob on that one, but only because I think he's the better all-round martial artist. I don't underestimate the blunt force trauma that Vettori brings to the table, though. What the fuck, bro? I was riding my balls. what fight was that? I can't remember. It was hilarious. Go on, I'll have a couple more.
In your opinion, which division do you find the most interesting?
Oh. Which division do I find? Well, to be honest, overall, probably one of the lighter divisions. Bantamweight currently is one of my favorites. You know, I was really impressed with the fight between Cruz and Vera on both sides. I thought Dominic Cruz looked really good. I thought he was a lot more aggressive than I expected him to be. That was a really fascinating one because you've got two very differently skilled fighters. You know, Cruz is constantly on the move, high striking output, wrestling to back it up. And Vera, of course, is just a lot more aggressive, but there's still a very high level of skill, especially in these lighter weight classes. Like as we move up the weight classes, the level tends to thin out within the top 10, top 15. Like if you look at like flyweight at the moment, you know, you look at the guys towards the end of the division or bantamweight, we've just been talking about, you know, Umar Nurmagomedov, like Sean O'Malley, Jack Shaw's right there as well. You've got highly skilled fighters that are right inside the top 15. But then as we move up to heavyweight, you know, you've got fighters like, I mean, you know, Blagoy Ivanov, who's very tough and very durable, and Shamil Abdurakhimov, very tough and durable. But my hope is for in the future of mixed martial arts is that the skill level is so high that they're regional champions. Whereas the lighter weights, I think they're already in that position where the skill level is high enough for all of the fights to be competitive. In a lot of the weight classes, you're looking at sort of the top three, four that are competitive and the rest of them are some distance away. But the lighter weight classes, those gaps seem to be a lot narrower, in my opinion. And that's, for me, why they're more interesting. Go on, Jamie, I'll have one more, and then it's time for tea.
So, one from Ethan Hall, 7276. Do you think Luke was able to fix his defense with the help of Jason Perillo? If he has, how does he fare against Izzy?
Say that one more time.
So, do you think Luke Rockhold was able to fix his defense with the help of Jason Perillo? If he has, how does he fare against Izzy?
I don't know, and I suppose we're going to have to see what it looks like against Costa, because the good thing is that Costa is most likely going to throw a decent amount of strikes at him unless his confidence falls out in the beginning and he just kind of stands back and waits for Luke to do what he wants. Like Luke's a good martial artist. He's not the all-round striker that Izzy is, and I'm sure he probably feels like he is, just like Paulo Costa feels like he is. But honestly, from an outsider's perspective, watching what Izzy does in there, there are very, very few fighters that have got that level of understanding of striking. Like I'm only now starting to really see it, and I definitely was nowhere near it when I was competing. I had a few bits in my game that I could rely on that I knew worked quite well. And I had a few kind of subconscious games that I could play. But Izzy's like already there because he's had 75 kickboxing matches. He's already got a massive amount of experience at a good level where he's competing against guys that are different sizes and different body types. And because Izzy's not a banger, he's had loads and loads of time to fight rounds and rounds against guys and refine his skill set. Rockhold is a very good fighter, though. But he's probably a more well-rounded fighter than Izzy. I expect Rockhold, and I'm talking like ideal Rockhold. I'm talking Rockhold when he was on his win streak, going into the fight against Chris Weidman. That version of Rockhold could most likely take Izzy down. And that version of Rockhold would most likely be able to stand and trade with Izzy for a good portion of the fight before Izzy then starts to find ways to get the better of him. But the backup that Rockhold's got that he can grapple is something that I think would be something to put on the table. Rockhold's not there now, though, and this is what we have to keep in mind. You know, it's been, what was it, July 2019 was the last time he fought. 3 years out, coming off two knockout losses. He's not the strongest of people, like, in his self-belief. I mean, you know, I might be speaking out of turn, but I'm just telling you what I think. Like, you remember the whole shot with him, you know, sitting front row with Nate Diaz, and Nate Diaz is like, straight away, this is who I am. You know who I am. And Rockhold's like, kind of Ricky Bobby, not sure what to do with his hands. Like, you look at him and you're like, he should be super confident and, you know, like, you should walk around like he's James Bond. But he just doesn't. Like, the confidence that he should have just doesn't seem to be there. And that really, really is a problem when it comes to fighting. Like, a lot of the time, Rockhold will say something and I'm like, I feel like he's trying to say that so he could hear it himself. I think he looks better this time around, but he's still in that position where he's not fought in 3 years. He's coming off two losses. He's had five losses on his record and they've all been knockouts, and he's 37. I don't know. I mean, I feel like the odds are stacked against him and that Paulo Costa should beat him. So I don't really think like the conversation about Izzy comes into the equation. But what I do think is if Rockhold's able to get past Paulo Costa, he's going to be fighting Izzy next. Especially if Izzy keeps the belt against Pereira, of course. But then Rockhold's already talked a load of trash about Pereira as well. So he's kind of edging his bets and setting himself up for that as well. If Rockhold wins this, we'll see him in a title shot next, because he's towards the end of his career. They can cash in on his name. They can put a win on somebody else's record and use him as cannon fodder to build up the next guy. That will at least be the promotional perspective of Rockhold and how they can utilize him best to make money. The reality is he has got the skills to beat these guys. He just needs the self-belief to back it up. And Jason Perillo's a great striking coach. He really is. His ability to... I'm always most impressed with Jason Perillo in the corner. The way he walks up to people and it's just kind of matter of fact, deepest voice in MMA. And he's like, right, what we got to do here? You know what you got to do. It's all right. And he'll give him a bit of a drink. And it's just super chill, very, very commanding though. And I feel like someone like Rockhold would respond really well to that. I feel like he needs someone that's kind of calm and reassuring in the corner. So if it does get back to that after that first round and, you know, Paulo Costa's been pouring on the pressure, that little conversation between rounds with Jason Perillo might be a defining factor in Rockhold's performance. We'll see. I'm interested. How are we doing, Jamie? Any more standout questions? We all good? Make sure you check out the other war rooms. We've got Aldo against Mirab Dvalishvili. We've got Paulo Costa against Luke Rockhold up on the channel. The Outlaw Picks podcast is up on the channel as well, with myself and Veronica going through the whole card and talking about a whole bunch of fights. Make sure you check out my breakdown show on the BT Sport YouTube channel. If you're outside of the UK, most likely it's now been geo-blocked, because that's the games that are being played. I should probably address this now. I did tweet earlier today, because there's a new UFC breakdown show up, which is Fitzy and Saif Saud. I had a bit of a dig at him earlier today. It was not a dig at Fitzy or Saif Saud by any means. It was a bit of a dig at the UFC, as you know, because they get my thing geo-blocked and then they produce something that's pretty much exactly the same. It is what it is. My disrespect was towards the UFC and the way that they went about that, not towards Fitzy or Saif Saud. I just want to make that clear. Like, that show takes a lot of work. And I know that he would have started work on that, you know, a good couple of weeks ago. So check it out. Leave a nice comment for the coach, because it's not an easy job to do. And I'm hoping they've found someone that can stand in that role and do a really good job of it, because in my opinion, most people just don't want to put the work in. And that's really what this job is about. It's not about anything, any special set of eyes or special lessons or enlightenment and none of that shit. It's about putting the work in, watching the hours of tape and being open to learning new things. It's not an easy thing to do. And I think Safe Sour would be very good at it. So make sure you check that out as well. But also make sure you check out my BT Sport Breakdown show and vote for me for Analyst of the Year, because, yeah, why not? All good, Jamie? Any more questions? We all good? Go on. I'll have one more. It's getting a bit warm in here now.
Okay, so just to finish off, who do you think will lose their belt first, Kamaru Usman or Israel Adesanya?
Oh man. See, like, of course Izzy could lose to Alex Pereira, but I kind of don't feel like he's going to this time around. I feel like MMA is his forte, his forum. And I feel like Alex, although he's clearly a very skilled striker, I don't feel like he's got the comfort and the range management that Izzy's got now, especially with him having more time to kind of flesh out his striking skills in MMA. And I also think that the smaller gloves suit Izzy better because he's a sharpshooter. So I'm leaning towards Usman against Leon. I wish Leon all the best, but I'm just calling it objectively. I'm leaning slightly towards Usman, but maybe by 4 or 5%. I think Izzy's most likely going to beat Alex Pereira, which means they'll both keep the belt. So it's probably going to be the next challenger that comes along. And it might be Rockhold. If it's Rockhold, then I think Izzy's probably going to keep his belt. If it's Paulo Costa, he'll definitely keep his belt. I think Chimaev's the one to watch. I think he's the one that gets the belt. And I think he's probably got just as good of a chance of taking it off Izzy as he has off off Usman, to be honest. Scary dude. Maybe I'm just too much on the hype train, but I'm enough on the hype train to know that this is not a good fight for Nate Diaz, and I hope they have people around him looking after him as soon as that fight's over, because I think he's going to need a few stitches in his face. All good? Right. Thanks, everybody, for joining me. I always like talking to you guys. I am going to try and do these live streams as often as I can. Loads and loads of things going on this weekend. Of course, we've got UFC 278. We've also got MVP taking on Mike Perry. Anthony Joshua's fighting this weekend as well. I am going to be at the PFL, which I can't wait for. Chris Wade against Brendan Loughnane. You've got Cale Harrison on the card. We've got some really good UK stars coming through as well. Simeon Powell, Dakota Dechava. Featherweights, women's lightweights, that's the playoff for this weekend. The playoffs last weekend are all over, so those brackets are already sealed. And then in November for PFL 10, we're going to get all of the championships and all of the $1 million given out. So make sure you check PFL out this weekend as well, because there's going to be some really good fights on there. All right. Thank you, everybody, and I'll see you next time.